Eternal Father, we bow in your presence. We realize that it's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. We also understand that it's the delight to be in your presence, and the joy of the Lord is our strength. And Father, you teach us how to live both in the good times and in the bad. And Father, I ask that you be present here with this consideration we have here this evening. I ask that you would impress upon our hearts some reality and a glimpse and a burden for what the story represents. So I ask that you be present, that you would teach me what I should say and how I should say it. And I pray that all of us together might be impressed the fact that you are God and that you order the affairs of men. And you allow men to make choices that bring down terrible consequences upon themselves. So teach us, Father, and open our hearts to what you have for us. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, brothers and sisters, may the Lord disturb our hearts tonight. I really mean that. The song we just sang says He's the God of love, He's the God of mercy, He's the God of judgment, He's judging you. How can you go back out there and deny Him? There's nothing out there for the soul that's once known God. The story I told you last night was an awful story. And I have to tell you another awful story tonight. Except this one is awful in a different way. And folks, there's no way that I can convey to you the tragedy of this story. All I'm going to do tonight is scratch the surface a little bit and just help you understand. Folks, I've got to say at the beginning that the story that I'm about to tell you is not just a bit of suffering or even a wagon load of suffering. The story I'm about to tell you is an entire train load of suffering, lashed with a thunderstorm of tears. Now, I know the story in my mind, and I've suffered with the grief of reading it. And I recently saw this, well, about a year ago, I guess it was, I saw that DVD again, When They Shall Ask, and I shed tears once again. This story is tragic beyond description. It's the story of how heaven became hell in Russia. I tried to bring, I have a book at home called The Russian Dance of Death, and I tried to find it to bring to show you. Actually, I have two copies. I guess I loan them out, and I don't know where they are. Do any of you have The Russian Dance of Death in your libraries? Okay, we can talk about the surface things, but until you read the actual stories of the people who went through this, it cannot grip you like it should. So let's get started. The first signs of impending trouble began in 1914 when Russia joined Britain and France to fight Germany in World War I. The alternate service work in lieu of military service was not a problem. The Russian Mennonites spoke German, and that was the problem. The Russians suspected that the Mennonites somehow supported the national enemy. And then the Bolshevik Revolution happened in 1917. Tsar Nicholas II was deposed and killed. And then Vladimir Lenin and his communist cronies took over Russia. Lenin promised dramatic reforms that would benefit the urban poor. And some of the Mennonite intellectuals supported the idea of greater justice. But the point was, if you were a property owner or a business owner, you were a kulak. And you need to have your property taken and given to the people who don't have property. That was the whole point. But it soon became clear that not only that was to happen, but Lenin wanted to destroy religion as part of his classless society ideal. Let me pause. All this grows out of Karl Marx's work. Karl Marx invented communism, I guess you could say, along with Friedrich Engels. And by the way, he was a Jew. But it was an idea. It was never tried. He wrote this book, Das Kapital, and Lenin wanted to put it into practice. But it would take revolution to make it work. And they were about to do whatever it took to make this work. And the tragedy is, it was an experiment that failed after 70 years. There's a few hang-ons like North Korea today, and Cuba, and Vietnam, and I don't know, maybe who else is communist anymore. But it's basically a failed experiment that cost millions and millions and millions and millions and millions of people's lives. To discover it doesn't work. Lenin was willing to kill and to create revolution. Stalin followed him and killed even more, 20 million people. Mao Zedong, when it came to the Cultural Revolution of 1949 in communist China, was willing to kill 60 to 80 million more, only to have it fail. Well, at the end of World War I, Russia made peace with Germany in 1918. As part of the peace deal, German soldiers would occupy Ukraine where most of the Mennonites lived. And the Mennonites were doubly glad. War was over, and the Germans were coming to maintain law and order. But the Russian natives noticed. They were more sure than ever that Mennonites were Russian traitors. Then the tide quickly turned when Britain and France defeated Germany, and the German soldiers needed to go home. And the German soldiers warned the Mennonites that the Russian peasants would take revenge against the German-speaking people. And so before they left, they taught some Mennonite young men how to defend themselves with guns. And they left some guns there. They said, but you're going to need them. But when the Germans left, Ukraine was left in a vacuum. Law and order broke down. And Russians began to rob Mennonite farms and to kill their landowners. And this is a part of what Lenin wanted. Not only the Russians were doing this, robbing and pillaging and murdering. But the war front was right in the Mennonite settlements. The White Army would go this way. Then the Red Army would go this way. And the bandits would do their thing. And it was just one hell on earth. Here's just a picture of a little bit of the hell. This is just five members of the Thiessen family murdered during the anarchy that followed the Russian Revolution. That's mild. That looks nice compared to the story. Over time, I'm just pulling the story out of my head here. These anarchists were worse than the Bolsheviks and the White Army. I'll read to you some more about this kind of stuff. One story that sticks in my mind. These guys would come in, and in this particular story I'm thinking about, they killed. There was a family sitting up at their table when they came in. So they killed them all, cut their heads off, and placed the head at each plate. So the family is still sitting there, just with their heads on the table. That's the kind of people we're talking about. The people would kill at the blink of an eye. I mean, these people didn't even respect good people. For example, David and Catherine Dick, founders of the Mennonite Tract Society, were known for their generosity. But they were willing to kill them too, just on a snap like that. It didn't matter. From there, anarchy and chaos continued as the new Soviet Union descended. The whole Soviet Union descended into civil war. The White Army fought to reinstate the Tsar. The Red Army fought to keep the Bolsheviks in power. That's the communists. And like I said, the battleground was Ukraine. As the army swept across the land through village after village, destroying property, confiscating food, and leaving the helpless inhabitants with little of their own. Time and time and time again. On top of that, a third group of anarchists, people who believe in no government, fought only to loot, to steal, and create havoc as they pillaged the landscape. Their black flag carried the words, "Anarchy is the mother of all order." And also one of their watchwords, "Plunder the plunderers." The people who had businesses were assumed to have plundered the Russians. Now it's time to plunder them. Go in and get what you want. And the worst of all, as I said, were this Nestor Makhno, leader of the anarchist bandits. He was familiar with the Mennonites, possibly having worked for a Mennonite farmer. And this Makhno led 100,000 men in their lawless terrorism. He and his men were cunning and ruthless. They would appear out of nowhere, many times at night, just to come in, rob, kill, rape, steal in the middle of the night. Just terrorized. Kortytsa, the old colony, suffered 400, including children, killed. 92 women raped. 16 villages burned to the ground. Then a typhus epidemic struck, killing 1,200 more. The survivors faced starvation because the bandits took 113 horses, 1,717 cows, 1,073 hogs, 40,000 bushels of wheat, and 10,000 bushels of barley. The discouraged living were just buried. The discouraged living people buried the dead in mass graves. They just couldn't keep up. The Russian Dance of Death tells story after story of this kind of thing. But that's not the only place where we have some of that story. Let's look at the geography here a little bit. This is the Kortytsa colony, the old colony. Malashna colony is off the side over here. You're not close enough to this map, but any place you see this symbol right here, that's a destroyed Mennonite village. And those of you in the front can see a number of them. Here's one. Some of these others are Russian villages. And the people in the Russian villages are the ones that are willing to come in and destroy. This was their fair time to go get what they wanted. Up here, there's a number of villages that are destroyed. Several. Here's another one. But Nestor Makhno himself, the bandit, lived across the river in one of these villages over here. He knew these people. Some people say that he worked for a Mennonite where the Mennonite exploited him and didn't treat him right, and this was his chance. I don't know if that's true or not. Some Mennonites who survived wrote down some of their story. And I'm just going to take a little bit of time to read from this book, Miracles of Grace and Judgment by Gerhard Schroeder. A family strives for survival during the Russian Revolution. I'm just breaking into the story here. The bandits went about their professed business of avenging the alleged injustices which the peasants of the area had suffered at the hands of the Mennonites and other colonists, and of course, to plunder the plunderers. Many an afternoon or towards evening, we would see hay racks loaded high with loot from farms and businesses of the surrounding area being driven into their neighbor's yard in this story. Now the benevolent leader's headquarters. Upon invitation from this modern version of a Robin Hood, the poor peasants from neighboring villages would appear in great numbers to share in the division of the spoils of the day. But we in the school were generally left unmolested except for an occasional prowler or two who might enter a classroom. Thus, one day, a group of them entered my room while I was teaching geometry. But they soon learned that they were prowling in the wrong place since they were obviously not interested in the study of geometry. Now, the unique thing about this particular man, He was only a teacher. He was not a plunderer. And so he was actually wise enough to be friends with this bandit leader who lived across the street. And that's a whole lot of story there. Anyway, with the establishment of this leader's headquarters at Schoenfeld, which is right off, Schoenfeld is right across the river, right over here. We were at the complete mercy of this, quote, little father and his henchmen. Semyon Pravda was, of course, only one, though admittedly one of the most notorious underlings of the supreme little father, which is Nestor Makhno, on the left bank of the Dnieper, as indeed throughout southern Russia during the years 1918-1920. Most of these Bakos professed to be anarchists, if not in philosophy, at least in action. Their slogan was freedom, which they interpreted as a license to do anything they please, steal, rob, plunder, kill for alleged cause, or simply because at a given moment it happened to strike their fancy to show their contempt for a human life, which was not on their level of on bestiality, and therefore was entered as expense, to use one of their favorite expressions for such acts of terror. Let me cite a few examples of the type of experiences most of us were exposed to during the reign of the bandits. It was commonplace for Makhnovets like blah, 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 or for a group of them, to storm into a house at any time of the day or night and demand that a chicken dinner be prepared and be served within so many minutes, or the housewife would have to take the consequences. Or some bandit might spot a ring on the finger of a woman and demand then and there that it be surrendered to him. I remember a case of a teacher by the name of Isaac who lived near Schoenfeld. A member of a band happened to be noticed the wedding ring on the hand of the teacher's wife. He demanded that she give it to him immediately. When she was unable to do so quickly enough because of a swollen finger, he threatened to kill her then and there. A similar incident befell one of the farmers in our school district and with tragic consequences. His name was Warkington. He was a widower. After the bandits had taken his horses, they loaded the wagons with booty of anything they could find in the house. Among the expropriated items was a watch, which was particularly dear to this man since it was a gift from his deceased wife. When he begged for its restitution, a member of the gang raised his revolver and killed him, point blank, shot in the head, with the accompanying words, "There, you can have your watch." The frightfulness of our experiences at the hands of these people was often heightened by the fact there were rival gangs among them, who at times tried to outdo each other in acts of terror upon the hapless victims, the hapless human beings whom they chose at the moment to be the victims of their lust for blood. Thus, one day, in a neighboring Lutheran village about 5 miles away from Schoenfeld, a band of these bandits seized 9 farmers and hanged them in the barn of one of their victims. The local Lutheran pastor and a friend of mine, Mr. Blah, 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 who was a teacher in this village, was called to come to the farmhouse to conduct the mass funeral. The pastor, having been called on another errand of mercy, left immediately after the service, but then he returned. Suddenly, the assembled mourners noticed that the house was being encircled by a group of bandits. Anyone trying to escape was shot on the spot. Soon the frame building was surrounded by piles of straw and set on fire. All inside perished in the flaming structure, including my friend and fellow teacher, with whom only a few weeks earlier I had traveled to attend a district teacher's conference. Truda and I, this man's wife, decided to comfort this widow now as far as it was possible for us to do. She was able to stay with us for a number of days. In view of the fact that the entire Warkington family had fled, Bako Prava and his immediate entourage, who had quartered themselves in the abandoned farmhouse, needed someone to cook for them. They conscripted for this job a widow, Mrs. Klein, and her 2 daughters, who lived in a small cottage on the Warkington farmstead. How we trembled over their fate and prayed for their safety. I would see them on occasions when I had to go to Pravda's headquarters and at times when this leader would order that some food be prepared for us. But the Lord protected these women. As far as I know, they suffered no personal harm from the bandits. On one of my visits, Pravda drew his revolver from his pocket and proudly announced that with this pistol I've already killed 56 people. The last victim was a doctor from Alexandrovsk. Then he added, "You know, I will never be taken alive by my enemies. When my end comes, I will simply put this gun to my head." And this he did in 1921 in a certain village. In the vicinity of Schoenfeld lived a number of wealthy Mennonite landowners on their private estates. Now remember some of those pictures I showed to you in the golden era. Probably something like that. One group, often a group of closely related families who live on the same kutor, or in close proximity to each other, generally having originally purchased a big estate from a Russian noble family or a wealthy member of the gentry or commercial class. One such large and wealthy Mennonite family near Schoenfeld was named Schroeder. All such estate owners, such as these Schroeders, except for those who in the early fall of 1918 had fled either to Malachna or to the Crimea, suffered indescribable tortures at the hands of these bandits and paid a frightful toll in the number of their members murdered by these bandits. Let me briefly list the fate of a number of members of this particular family. The first to be murdered was Abraham Schroeder and the manager of his estate. They had driven a relatively short distance from the estate to look over some fields when they were surprised by a troop of these bandits and were forthwith killed by having their throats slit and left to bleed to death. Neighbors accidentally happened to discover their bodies. Next came two nephews of his, Gerhard and Peter, sons of Abram's brother. They were overtaken on the road while driving to Schoenfeld. As they were nearing the Mennonite colony of Brazo, about 4 miles from our village, they noticed a group of mounted bandits coming down the road. They tried to escape, but were soon captured and greeted with horrible cursings. "Oh, here you are, you bloody dogs, you bloodsuckers of the poor. We'll settle our account with you today. Back toward Brazo, for we have to present you to our Bakno Makno. He will be glad to see such boys before eating his supper." The begging, crying, pleading of the two young men was in vain. Triumphantly, they were brought before Makno, who praised the men for their courageous act of catching the exploiters of the poor and of the laborers. Makno reminded them of the fate that was in store for such people and told his men to proceed with their act of revenge. The victims were ordered to undress, and then they were hacked to pieces. The wife of the slain Gerhard Schroeder Jr. was an expectant mother at this time, and not too long after this terrible tragedy, her husband came to Schoenfeld to get the maternity nurse, Miss Harder. I tried as well as I could to extend my sympathies to him and to his family and to console him by calling to his attention the words of Revelation 7:14. He expressed his appreciation for my words of sympathy and then said, quote, "It is so hard to keep faith in these dark times and to believe there is a just God when we see how such unrighteousness and iniquity are spreading in our country." Skipping a little bit. The tragedies for the Schroeder family continued during these terrible days in the late 1918, the early part of 1919. Not many weeks after two of his sons had been massacred, Gerhard Schroeder Sr. and his son Willie were slain in the family home after the house had once more been thoroughly ransacked and anything of value loaded and carted away. For reasons known only to this particular band of bandits, Mrs. Schroeder was not harmed. A few days later, I accompanied a family from our vicinity to the funeral on the Schroeder estate for the latest victim of the heavily bereaved family. When we reached the outbuildings of the estate, we noticed that there were many bandits in the yard. We feared for our lives. But when I asked one of the mounted bandits whether I could go and visit a teacher friend who lived nearby, he said, "Go ahead." And from the teacher's dwelling, we could see that the Schroeder's place was overrun by these bandits, and we feared that there might be a mass slaughter of people who would come to the funeral. After prolonged waiting, however, we received a message that the bandits were in the process of leaving and the funeral service was about to take place. The service was very short. And so, two more members of this family were buried. The only survivor of its older members was Henry, brother of the slain Gerhard and Abram Schroeder. I felt strongly that he was risking too much by staying in our area, and I urged him as insistently as I could to leave for a safer place, but he would not heed my pleas. At the beginning of September 1919, my family and I decided it was not safe for us to remain in Schoenfeld, and therefore we moved to Rosenthal to stay at the home of my parents. Henry Schroeder stayed, despite increasing signs that the white armies might not be able to hold on to the territory, which during the late spring and summer of the year they had wrested from the Red Army and its then ally, these bandit bands. Henry Schroeder, skipping ahead a little bit, Henry Schroeder happened to be among the first to be slain. He was killed in the orchard of his sister who lived in Schoenfeld, where he had hoped to be temporarily safe. And this goes on and on and on with the stories. And ten-year-olds don't need to be reading books like this. It is so awful. And the same with the Russian Dance of Death. Okay, when the Germans were there, they gave some young men some weapons. And whenever the young men saw all this stuff going on, they decided, shall we just stand by and let this happen? The Mennonite young men who had learned to handle weapons from the Germans decided to intervene. Church leaders agonized over what to tell these young men. Everyone lived in fear. No one had ever lived in a situation of chaos like this before. No government existed. Only roaming, undisciplined armies. The church leaders could not bless defense units, so they finally left the matter with the individual consciences of the young men. And these young men formed selbstschutz, self-defense units, using the weapons and ammunition left by the vacating Germans. The Lutheran and Catholic German colonies did the same. At first, the Mennonite militia seemed successful in the Molochna area. But the Mennonite militia was soon outnumbered and outgunned. Machno and his bandits focused their brutality on the people who had compromised their professed values. The compromisers were targets for revenge. Furthermore, some Mennonites had mistakenly fought the Red Army. Now the communists could claim that the Mennonites were the enemies of the state. A Red Army generally angry told the Mennonites, you claim to be non-resistant when it comes to fighting for your country, but you become resistant to defend your possessions. However, it is true, most Mennonites did not take up arms. But this civil war shattered the Mennonite colonies in this area. The horses and cattle were gone. The crops and grain were gone. On top of these miseries, it seems as if God Himself increased the suffering by bringing drought and a dreadful famine into the land. An act of God. First, the children and old people died. Then the ones in between. Many Mennonites felt like the judgment of God was falling upon them. And you'll notice that the title of this book is Miracles of Grace and Judgment. Well, stories like this don't just stay in Russia. In 1920, the Russian Mennonites sent four men to visit the Mennonites in Europe and North America to tell this terrible story. The response was immediate. Canadian and American Mennonites sent food and supplies for the suffering, as well as set up the Mennonite Central Committee, called MCC, to coordinate their work. But MCC could not freely do its work until 1921 because of the reigning chaos. A government relief agency named American Relief Administration assigned MCC to the Mennonite area of Ukraine. And for 3 years, MCC distributed food to 75,000 people, mostly Mennonite, saving thousands from starvation. And it was this work where the Swiss Mennonites, who is what the MCC is, we were able to pay back the debt we had to the Dutch when they paid our way across the ocean way back in the 1700s. By 1924, the Red Army had gained control, bringing the civil war and anarchy to an end. And once again, the surviving farmers began to produce crops. The famine is over. The civil war is over. And so they're producing crops with the little bit that they had. I have a book here that shows, with the horses gone, guess who pulls the plows? People. Once the farms began to produce crops, MCC emergency feeding programs ended. But, as the communists took over the government, they also took over the farmland to form collectives. You see, under communism, nobody owns private property. The government owns it all. And they put these various farms into a big collective. And they still have those collectives over there. I think they're breaking some of them up now to put back into private ownership. But the communists took complete control not only over the farmland to make collectives, but they took complete control over the education so that they could promote atheism, the belief that there is no God. At the same time, the communist government began to round up church leaders to send them into exile in Siberia. By now, the Mennonites wanted to leave Russia, the land of nightmares. And between 1923 and 1929, 22,000 Mennonites emigrated to Canada. That's a significant number. 22,000 got out at that time. But by 1929, the communists were closing the gates. And the Canadian government also needed to end the exodus because the Great Depression had come to North America. The door had closed. 80,000 Mennonites would remain behind, unable to leave. And for these 80,000, their misery and sorrow was just beginning and would continue for many long years. But hope springs eternal in the human breast. 70 desperate Mennonites fleeing famine and a heavy government hand in Siberia one day showed up in Moscow, trusting somehow that they might be permitted to leave. And wonder of wonders, the Soviet government said, yes, you may leave. The news spread like wildfire among the Mennonites, quietly to avoid suspicion, and some in such haste that they just left their property behind. About 1,000 Mennonite families showed up in Moscow, somehow hoping the Dutch or American Mennonites would rescue them. And more followed, until 14,000 Mennonites had hurried to Moscow, hoping to somehow emigrate. And to make their desires public, they demonstrated in Moscow's Red Square. Now, the Soviet Union had boasted it was the freest country in the world. But economic conditions and general dissatisfaction belied the claim. The free world press delighted to publish the irony of so many people wanting to emigrate. They had their photographers there, showing pictures of all these people wanting to emigrate. And the communists said, this is the freest land there is. Now, how do you put that together? And so they made fun of the Russian government. And the Soviet government was embarrassed. Well, since this came to the light of the free press, what could the communist authorities do? Well, the communist authorities herded these unwilling Mennonites into freight train cars and sent them back to Ukraine, or exiled them to Siberia. They gave no regard for food, clothing, or sanitation. Families became separated, some shipped to one place and some to another. Some became sick because of exposure and neglect. Back east, they were worse off than they had been before they left. They had no household furniture, no farm equipment, and no livestock, and many, when they got home, found somebody else was living in their house and their farm, and life was harder than ever. But the free world had gotten the story. The German government intervened with President von Hindenburg, which was before Hitler. President von Hindenburg donated 200,000 marks from his own private fortune to help with emigration. And so Germany agreed to take 6,000 refugees, 4,000 of them Mennonites, after all. But only 4,000. And that was to somehow counter this negative press the communists were getting. 1,000 of these people went to Brazil, 2,000 of them went to Paraguay, and the rest to relatives in Canada. And then the door slammed shut firmly. And that was 1929. No more getting out. After Lenin died in 1924, Joseph Stalin rose to power in the USSR as a brutal dictator, making life yet harder for most of the Soviet people. His government arrested more and more pastors and teachers, and thus more and more people became desperate to flee. In their desperation, some Mennonites moved to eastern Russia to a location near China. And there's a whole book written on this story. Maybe some of you have it. It's called River of Glass. These people were ingenious on their way to get out. You know, Russia has a huge east-to-west length. So Moscow is on the eastern side of Russia. They decide if we go to the extreme, I'm sorry, Moscow's on the western side of Russia. If we go to the extreme east side of Russia, over near Japan, you know, maybe we can get out. So they planted a colony over there, and they made plans. They did it really nice. Everything was above board so that nobody would suspect anything. But the whole point was to get across the border. And they knew the border was guarded. And in this story, it tells what happened. They decided to leave as an entire village of 217 people. They loaded themselves up in sleighs, and they waited for one of the coldest nights of the year, 40 degrees below zero. And it was a mist that was hanging. And so, when the signal was given, they just took off with their sleighs, went down the riverbank. One of the sleighs fell to pieces, crashed to pieces, but they picked everything up and went on. And they all got across. Okay, now they're in China. What are they going to do in China? Well, they waited in China. And of course, this kind of stuff embarrasses governments, but they got themselves processed and they actually got themselves out. It was a rather ingenious plan. These people right here moved to Reedley, California, close to where my son lives, or to Brazil or to Paraguay. Joseph Stalin ordered several purges in the 1930s. Those are political purges. The government forbade worship. It labeled as kulak anyone who had prospered under the Tsar. That meant that most Mennonites got the label kulak. During Stalin's purges, many undesirables were simply killed. Farms were collectivized, meaning farms were joined together and run by a central command station. There, women and children struggled to exist without husbands and fathers, because the husbands and fathers were either killed or exiled into Siberia. Let me read to you another story. This is from the book Through Fire and Water. I did forget to mention, here's a book, Days of Terror by Smucker, that it's on a children's level that some of you may have in your homes, but it describes this time of terror with his bandits. Now, the story I'm going to read to you now is later under Joseph Stalin. This is not over the time of the bandits. This is the story of Anna, Nicholas, and their three children in one of the Mennonite villages in Ukraine to illustrate what happened to many, many other people. This is just one story. It was September 1937. The family had gone to bed, hoping that they would be spared what had happened to so many of their relatives and friends in the last few weeks. Nicholas, a veterinarian, was a useful and productive citizen on the collective farm, but that did not guarantee him safety. Officials had recently imprisoned his father, an expert horticulturalist, on trumped-up charges. Then, after midnight, the family heard a loud knock on the window and a voice demanding that the door be opened. Anna turned to her husband and murmured, "Now they've come to get you." She dressed and began to sob quietly. Nicholas got up, lit a lamp, dressed, and opened the house door. Two secret policemen entered and ordered Nicholas to go with them. They searched drawers for documents and valuables, including mail from relatives in North America. It was a crime to have connections with a foreign country. When they finished, they took Nicholas by his arms and led him to the door. Nicholas turned to say goodbye to Anna and the children. He stopped at the bed of his six-year-old son and whispered, "My dear boy, perhaps I'll never see you again. Be good to mother and help her as much as you can." Anna was weeping uncontrollably. One of the policemen said, "Don't cry. Your husband will soon be back." Anna snapped, "Don't give me that. I know how he'll return. He'll never come back." The door closed, and Anna and her children heard the car drive away. The children never saw their father again. During the next few weeks, Anna was permitted to visit her husband in local prison, taking him food and clothing. One day, Nicholas returned his shoes, telling Anna that he did not need them anymore. When Anna examined them at home, she found the insides soaked with blood. Guards had tortured Nicholas until he agreed to sign a confession that he had poisoned the cattle on the collective farm. Anna never saw her husband after that. Nicholas and his father, the horticulturalist, were both shot shortly thereafter. Thousands of Soviet citizens were exiled to harsh prison labor camps known as the Gulag. in Siberia. Somewhere between 40 and 60 million people died in Stalin's prison camps. So we're not only talking about Mennonite suffering, we're also talking about the entire nation suffering. Half the Mennonite men disappeared during this purging period. During this time, 15 million Soviet citizens would vanish without a trace. Then World War II began. In 1941, the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union. And when the Soviet Union heard that the Nazis were coming, they sent an emergency order out. If there's any Mennonite men that are still around on any of these farms, ship them east as soon as possible. They did not want the Nazis to get in touch with these Mennonite men. Well, these Nazis soon came in and occupied much of the Ukraine, where thousands of Mennonites, but mostly women and children, still lived. And the Mennonites were overjoyed to have Germans show up. And believe it or not, the Nazis allowed churches to reopen, and the Mennonites quickly reopened their schools. But the Mennonites did notice that the Nazis were killing Jews. 2 years later, the tide of the war turned. The Russian armies began to chase the Nazis back out of Russia. Some Mennonites saw their chance to escape the Soviet Union and fled to Germany early. Smart people. But most joined a mass movement of Germans trying to escape ahead of the retreating German Nazi army. And I talked to you about that last night with the Nazi story in Prussia. It's like a wave just of the Russian army just pushing west and pushing all the Nazis, just sweeping the land as it went. When it came to the Vistula River area, they just swept and killed and destroyed any Mennonites were there that lingered. In the cold of winter, many children and old people simply died on the way. But about 35,000 refugees reached Germany. But then, right at the end of the war, the Russian army overtook the Nazi army and caught up with these fleeing refugees. And so the Soviets simply rounded up 23,000 of these Mennonites and once again sent them back into the Soviet Union. But 12,000 were so close that they escaped into the western part of Germany, which was occupied by the British or American forces. Those of you who studied World War II history know that Germany was divided into four zones. The French zone, the British zone, American zone, and the Russian zone. If you got into one of those free zones, you made it. But if you were only in the Soviet zone, you got shipped back. Well, these people who made it across into these free zones, once again, were taken care of by MCC. And MCC wanted to see if there's any country that would take them. Eventually, 6,000 were allowed to go into Canada. And 6,000 were allowed to go to South America, mostly to Paraguay. In this book, Henry's Red Sea took place at this juncture. I borrowed this from your school library. You can read about this story, Henry's Red Sea, and the Volendam carrying their people. For more than 40 years, after World War II, thousands of Mennonites continued to live in the Soviet Union under harsh conditions. But they're chased out here. Some joined Baptist churches. Almost all lost their Mennonite identification. But every cloud has a silver lining when the sun is shining. In the 1980s, remarkable changes began to happen in the Soviet Union as the communist government lost its grip on power, as the communist experiment was failing, and began to allow people of German background to leave. Between 1987 and 1993, almost 100,000 people of Mennonite origin left the Soviet Union to resettle in Germany. This movement of people has been the largest Mennonite migration in history, in their history. The newcomers to Germany were called the Umsiedler. Let me pause there. If you could prove to the German government that you had German ancestry, the German government would pay to have you moved from the Soviet Union to Germany. And almost all the remaining German origin people took advantage of that offer and they went to Germany. But when they got to Germany, the Umsiedler are still in that process finding it difficult to feel comfortable in Germany, where materialism and a sex-obsessed media hold sway. They note that many people in Germany, Mennonites included, are only nominally Christian. At church, singing is a major part of their worship. They prefer the old hymns of their past rather than the lighter, shallower, contemporary music. And when I saw this DVD, When They Shall Ask, something in my spirit clicked. When I saw these Umsiedler worshiping, I felt kinship to their spirit. They would feel comfortable here. These are the people who accepted what God had done and responded to Him in faith. And you could see joy and peace in these people's lives. Eugene Hirsch just showed me last night, whenever his family was in Ukraine, where his brother Wayne is, the Mennonite church in that area was west of Kyiv, I understood. When the Mennonites had to flee, they had to leave their churches, their farms. And this particular church had a nice high ceiling. That's the way Russian Mennonites make their churches, with high ceilings. They turned this church into a granary. And so they just simply broke open the walls, the front doors of the church, so you could back a dump truck in, into the church, and they could dump the grain out inside the church. Okay? Now, in more recent years, people have gotten that church building and have restored it to what it used to look like. And if you want to see that, talk to Eugene. He has a picture of it. And the farm that's close by used to be a Mennonite farm as well. For these people, life is no longer about the golden age of financial, social, and cultural prosperity. For them, for these Umsiedler who have been purified by suffering, today is the golden age of faith. And today, as we speak, the Russian Mennonite story has basically ended. But just a few years ago, once again, the land formerly occupied by the Kortytsa and Malashna colonies is once again the scene of war and suffering, if you followed the news. But this time, the Mennonites are gone. And I have a few other overheads I would like to share with you before I close. Ukraine is the breadbasket of Europe. That's why it was focused on by these bandits. And this is the area that we're talking about. As I told you, there were two other places that that Mennonites went to. Here's Amtrak, and here's Alt-Samara. They're out of this area. So these people did not experience banditry like these people down here. This is where the focus of all those terrible things that happened. But these people over here did suffer later whenever Stalin had his purges. If you look at the film, When They Shall Ask, all Mennonites wanted to see this site. This is the gate at Latvia. This is the train. When you went through that gate, you could rejoice in freedom. Until you were on, as long as you were on this side of the gate, you could be turned around and taken back. But once you pass through that gate, it's glory, hallelujah, we're free. It's called the Red Gate, through which Mennonites passed as they left the Soviet Union to Canada through the 1920s. Here's a very interesting picture. This is a picture of German soldiers. Here are Mennonite women walking. The German occupation, can't even read that. German occupation forces and ethnic German civilians in the Malashna settlement in 1942. This is during World War II. You see those people? There's hope in their faces. These are my people. These are German Nazis. And they're going to help us. German officers survey massacred German civilians in the aftermath of the Soviet advance into East Prussia in 1944. Happened over and over and over again. Now, I don't know if those are Mennonites or not. So, the final question, where did they go? If Russia is now emptied of Mennonites, where have they gone? Well, many have gone to Canada in several waves. 18,000 went in 1874, and again in 1922-26, many more did. Some went straight to Mexico. Some moved from Canada, from Manitoba to Mexico. Some went to Paraguay. Some came from Ukraine to Paraguay. Some to Brazil. Some to Uruguay. It doesn't show down here. But some of the Nazis, Mennonite Nazis, went to Uruguay and Paraguay. And I think I told you that story last night. But there's been a little tragedy in the making. The Mennonites have never forgotten the heaven that they've had in Russia. And I heard that there are some Mennonites who are thinking about buying these lands back again. And I'm thinking, folks, do you know the Russians? Why do you want to do that? That's all I can say. Okay, in conclusion, does anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask? Oh, here, I did want to say this. I looked in your library and you have this story. This book, Mennonite Exodus, which is the rescue and resettlement of the Russian Mennonites since the Communist Revolution by Frank Epp. And the job of a teacher is to work himself out of a job. I have only scratched the surface. Here is at least one book where you could go a little further. And these other books are available as well. Buy them. Read them. Think about them. Think about the implications for our times as well. Do you have any questions?